Now, for our second hour, we hear Tony Gosling speaking on the 13th of October, 2012, at the Awakened State Conference in Edinburgh.
What I'll be talking about today is really some of my experiences in journalism that have led to taking a very dim view of the modern mainstream media. I'm also an activist within the National Union of Journalists in the new media side, and you know, we're campaigning amongst journalists for more truth-seeking in journalism. And I would stress, it's very easy to blame journalists, just like it's easy to blame politicians, particularly after the expenses scandal. What we forget is that many of those who were some of the worst abusers of expenses, such as Tony Blair, the information about them, for some reason, never appeared. Oh, we've lost the information for Tony Blair. The same, in a way, is true with journalists. You know, you get a little bit of some and not the others, because what's going on there is that it's not the journalists that control what's actually going out. It's the own, and we often forget, it's the owners of the transmitters, who, by the way, in this country for the BBC are Siemens, the last time I knew, and it's the managers and the editors that make the decisions about whether the journalists' information is going to get out there to the public. So I suppose the theme of this afternoon for me is really to do with this word context. If you're not putting the news into context, you're not actually understanding what's going on as a journalist, as an editor, or as an audience. And I will take a few positions now. One of those is that I don't believe that the Nazis were defeated in the Second World War. I believe they always planned to use the loot that they'd looted from Europe to set up a kind of financial network. And I'll be talking about that a bit later. And this is one of those basic things that I think so much of the mainstream press has got wrong. And I'll be putting forward some evidence to support that. We've got a kind of poisonous legacy from the Second World War, which is haunting the Western world. I mean, we've seen this in certain films, like things like the Odessa File books as well. And I'm sure you've all got your favourite sort of, oh, the Nazis survived the World War II films. But this is hinting at something which is actually really quite sinister. And if anyone's as old as I am, they may even remember the 1970s film by World in Action from Granada and Manchester, where they followed around the Nazis in South America and actually were tracking down and talking to the people from the Mossad. But we'll go into that a bit more later. I think there's a load of psychology involved in this as well. We've been talking about this a little bit earlier on today. The big lies. What that does is it disengages the public from the political process and also from the media. And it induces apathy. If you think that what's been going, you know, that the mainstream dialogue is lying, and that there are all sorts of lying positions in there, such as the position which even some of the Tory cabinet take, is that they want to deal with the problem of tax havens, where most of their own personal wealth is in those tax havens. And when David Cameron's father, Ian Cameron, was the pioneer of tax havens, when the exchange controls were lifted in the early 1980s, then you start to lose any kind of faith that there's any real debate going on. And this is repulsive. This, what it does is it just disengages us from that. And this is very dangerous, very pernicious. The prize, I suppose, in the media is that this is the nervous system for humanity, and increasingly it's global. I mean, Russia Today, for example, is a global channel, the BBC World, they are a global channel. And this is the nervous system by which we function. You know, this is what controls the limbs of the body politic, if you want. And when that's poisoned in the way that so much of the mainstream media is today, with false debates being put forward, people being allowed to lie without being held to account, then, you know, we are in a serious problem with humanity. And I talked about the Second World War, but this is like almost like a curse that won't go away. The First World War, you know, we thought that was it back after that. The war to end all wars, of course. Then it came back, but it still hasn't gone away. It's a language most people understand, to use that word, the curse that won't go away. Today it's haunting us in the form of what's happening in the Middle East and also with the financial crisis, and we'll talk about that a bit more later. This is one thing as a journalist. I mean, as I decided to get into journalism, I suppose it's a bit like Icarus. The closer you get to the sun, you start to realise, well, actually, some of these people who are running things, when you're meeting cabinet ministers and interviewing them, there's something wrong. These people are one person. When they're being interviewed, they're someone else as soon as you switch the tape recorder off, they've got a quite, you know, actually sinister personality, many of these people that I met whilst working in London. And I was only working in local radio as a researcher and a reporter in London. And it was a strange thing because we were working in London. We had a lot, for a start, Greater London Radio, where I was in the early 90s, had a very massive audience for our lunchtime and drive time programs. But also we were doing a lot of national and international stories, which is very rare for anyone working in local radio. So I was very privileged. And that journey, you get to a point where you realise, look, what's more important? Is it my career or the story? And I didn't really have much of a choice in my own heart there, because I could see that there were lots of stories that weren't being told. And so I decided I'm going to pursue these stories wherever they lead. And I think that takes a little bit of courage to say that to yourself, is even if this goes somewhere rather dark, rather like the public who are repelled by lies they see, by evil that they see in politics and in the mainstream news. You know, that also, journalists have that feeling too, you know. We were also repelled by that, and we think, well, actually, I'd rather go around that story. But actually, what I decided to do was to really to bite the bullet. And we mentioned the Second World War a little bit there, but Churchill said, "History will be kind to me, I know, because I will write it." And that starts me thinking about maybe we shouldn't be quite so kind to someone with that sort of arrogance. I mean, you know, there were wonderful things that the British did. We had David Cameron this week at the Conservative Party conference talking about, and I don't know how many people actually bothered to listen to his talk, but he actually said several things which just, to me, are complete nonsense. One of the key ones was, we beat the Nazis. Actually, it was the Russia Today types that beat the Nazis. Far more casualties than the Americans and the British combined and the French, you know, all together. It was Stalin's war machine going up against Hitler's war machine that was really the at the core of the European front in the Second World War. And so this kind of, you know, it's rather like when George Bush said something similar about the Americans winning World War II. You know, everyone wants to be the one credited with beating the Nazis. And there is a key thing with the Nazi empire and with the Nazi philosophy, which is part of that curse, which wouldn't go away. I don't think anybody's ever managed to create a system, at least that we know of, that was so pernicious. So what I'd like to do is spend about a quarter of an hour going through some what I think are important points of history. This is talking about going back to that idea of context, important points in history through the years, which we're really not made aware of. And but the theme that runs through these is really two things, which is land and money. Land, because the land is a free gift to humanity, and yet if you want to buy a little piece of land out there, or you want to use a little piece of land out there, you're talking hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pounds, to even start thinking about it. We're also in a situation now where many of our buildings are empty. They're just used as investments because there's low interest rates out there in the markets. And land is now being used as just a commodity that people invest in. They don't necessarily use it. I mean, we've got landowners, massive landowners, many of whom have got estates of thousands of acres that they've never even visited, never even seen. And land has become a commodity which needs to be shared out again. And it's great to see that in Scotland there has been this quite powerful land reform movement, and people like Andy Whiteman, people may have come across, who have been writing about the history of land up here. His book, if you haven't come across it, is an absolute must-read for history, for Scottish people. I don't want to lecture you too much on this, but it is called The Poor Had No Lawyers. And it talks about the clearances, and it talks about the absolute horrific abuse by the aristocracy, who were learning tricks from the English as to how to mistreat poor people up in Scotland. And the other is money. Talking about money, we could kind of start with the Roman invasion, really. Obviously, that didn't make its way up here, but it did make a big difference in the southern half of Great Britain, where this whole idea of money was kind of something quite new. There was ways of trading. People were exchanging things. The idea was originally that certainly that the land was not ownable. This was a resource which had to be used by everybody, and so therefore it had to be shared out. And the same was true with various types of wealth. Obviously, there was fighting going on amongst some people, but the idea that someone could have be denied anywhere that they could stay was really only something which took place in battles between, you know, one tribe or another tribe, or maybe when the Vikings invaded, this kind of thing. No, that's not your land. People will be fighting each other for land. So that was the introduction of money, effectively. We've got a situation with roughly 60 million acres in Great Britain and roughly 60 million people. And many of us are asking ourselves the question right now, where's my acre? Because when you've got the land, as the Crofters have done, you don't need to be actually using the land. It's just the fact that you've got it. If you're not, you may be working in IT and commuting. But if you've got that land, you can then rent it out to your neighbours. You've got a basic resource. Now, the Green Party, for example, are talking about this thing called a basic income. And effectively, it's the same thing as having the right to land. So the idea is that everybody needs these kinds of basic resources. And that what we're seeing now with benefit cuts in Britain, I noticed the Scottish have rejected this company Atos and said that they're not going to be doing any of these benefit assessments in the future up here. But we still have to cope with them back in England and Wales, unfortunately. This is actually what these benefits are, is compensation for stolen land over history. Now, you see what I mean by context. If you don't understand the context of stolen land taken away at sword point, knife point, you don't understand why you've got these mass numbers of unemployed people, and you simply cannot blame people who are unemployed, who are disabled, who don't have any resources, for claiming benefits, which is just compensation for stuff that's been stolen from them. With the Vikings, the Normans, the centralisation of power really starts. This is 1086, the Doomsday Book. I mean, do people know where the word Doomsday came from? This is 1086, not long after the Norman invasion. I'd just like to sort of gauge audiences does anyone like to shout out?
Judgment Day,
absolutely right. Thank you for being brave. Judgment Day, because the idea was once this had been drawn up, this was an inventory which was drawn up right across England, and everywhere then had to produce a tax on land, a tax of resources every year. Otherwise, people would be in jail. There was no appeal. That was the idea, that this was absolutely set in stone. And as the commissioners were going round after the Norman invasion, collecting all this information about the land and the resources, there were riots in some places. These commissioners were attacked. Some were injured. As far as I know, there were none killed. But the people were saying, a bit like we are now with the Big Brother Society, we don't want this invasion of our privacy. We would rather run our own affairs. We want a soft-touch government, not a hard-touch Big Brother state. And that's in a weird way, you know, that's the way they saw this as an invasion of their privacy, an invasion of their own sovereignty. And they could see that this was a slippery slope to centralised control. So then we have, that was 1086, then we have 1118 was the formation of this interesting organisation called the Knights Templar. Now, the Templars, very controversial historically, but there's a couple of things about them which convinced me that there's been a lot of rubbish, a bit like Churchill saying, we are going to write the history. They were a very, very wealthy organisation, and so they've left this kind of legacy through the history. Very positive legacy for a lot of people. They say, the Templars were very badly treated by Philip the Fair. Well, I'll tell you a couple of things about that. First of all, the arrest of the Templars and the torture of the Templars was not the only way that evidence was got about their crimes. And those crimes were pretty horrific. I mean, quite clearly they were not following any kind of Christian religion. There were three whistleblowers back in 1306, a year before the famous arrest of the Templars in 1307 on Friday the 13th of October. Gerard of Vizol, Esquin of Floyan, and Bernard Pellet, three former French Templars who'd gone to the authorities saying, I'm part of this organisation, but I've had enough. This, what they're doing is absolutely appalling and outrageous. And this really shows the lie of that all of the confessions were taken from the Templars under torture, and that they, you know, I'm no fan of torture, quite clearly, but this was more of a normal thing in those days. And it's quite fascinating to know that the initial impetus for this came from whistleblowers who've been largely forgotten, as so many of our whistleblowers today have. you know, they get marginalised by the mainstream press, they get bullied out of their jobs and disappear off into obscurity. We need to value our whistleblowers. The other thing is that the wealth of the Templars was what Philip was really after, Philip the Fair. And that's another lie, because the wealth went to two places, not to Philip. It went to the Knights Hospitaller. They took on a lot of the Templars' property in Malta and land in other places. And it also went to the Pope. So these are two just really important facts about that, which have kind of been buried and lost in obscurity. Then also, talking about land, then Statute of Merton was 1235. That was the first enclosure of private land in England. Now, this was the beginning of what eventually led to the clearances, which is this concept, which we're now looking at a different strata of that, which is genetic engineering, the privatisation of genetic material, genetic codes, that kind of thing. So that was the beginning of this whole idea of, you know, land privatisation. You know, we get annoyed about the way that we're now subsidising the railways three times more than we did before privatisation, back in the nationalised British Rail days. But this was a whole other strata beyond that, before that. If you go back as far as Leviticus, it's quite clear in the Old Testament, in the Book of Jubilee, it says the land is God's. That's what it says, basically. And you are my tenants. And then it says every 50 years we need to redistribute the land. Now, we haven't done that for quite a while. So it's about time we did. I mean, if we're looking at solving the financial crisis and looking at real security, what people need, what families need, is somewhere where no one's going to come and bang on the door and say, you haven't paid the rent, you're out. Because then what happens is people invest in their own place and they have that sense of real security, not some sort of private security guard knocking on the door or putting a lock on their door. After the Templars were abolished, of course, they had a warning of this. They'd moved much of their wealth. Then, not long after that, in 1348, something called the Order of the Garter was formed. This is the 26 knights who basically surround the British monarchy and the heir to the throne. So that was the idea right from the start, and it's still a very powerful little organisation today. They meet in Windsor Castle. But, you know, there's something suggests to me that there may be a connection between the Templars and the Garter Knights. Certainly they were both these sort of chivalric orders, very shrouded in secrecy, all people who were very generally very wealthy or powerful in one sort or another. And it's a way of kind of keeping it in the family, if you want. I don't know how many people were shocked as I was to hear the big news story with Frank Gardner, the BBC's royal correspondent, talking about how the Queen had phoned up David Blunkett or spoken to David Blunkett face to face and said, this guy, Abu Hamza, you know, why hasn't he been arrested? What is the Queen doing? Is she a figurehead or is she instructing a Secretary of State for the Home Office who to arrest and who not to arrest? It sounds very medieval. And I think that we really need to question the reality of the monarchy as some kind of figurehead. I think it's a very powerful force behind the scenes. And one of the places to look when you're looking at that power, of course, is this successor kind of organisation to the Templars, the Order of the Garter. People very often just think, oh, it's just a ceremonial thing. But who are those people? Who are those individuals? And what kind of power do they wield behind the scenes? I think that little story the other week was just a tiny little chink of light into something which is actually much more sinister, in that there are people out there who are very much behind the scenes, pulling the strings. Someone like David Blunkett, you know, the guy's blind, he's signing documents. You know, there is a way of almost taking the mickey, really, that this guy is just a figurehead of some sort and he can be easily manipulated. So, I mean, in terms of land, going forward in time a little bit more, 1535 to 40 was Henry VIII's dissolution of the monasteries. This was another massive change. Something like 900 monastic institutions were either demolished or taken over by the crown and by people who were loyal to Henry VIII. Now, that actually meant something like 10,000 monks and nuns sort of kicked out, lost their jobs. But this was a very a big shift in the idea that it was important to have a religious institution, a spiritual institution, if you want. I'm obviously a challenged spiritual institution, controlling much of the land and doing services, for example, hospital-type services that the monks used to offer, and producing food, wine, all that sort of thing, as producers. They were considered to be no good anymore, just as Henry VIII decided that he was going to start his own church because he didn't like what he was being told by the Vatican. So that was another really big change. Of course, that was a big reward. In those days, it was a lot of money. He had about £100,000 extra a year after the dissolution of the monasteries as revenues from those estates. We go on to 1549. That's another few years, to Kett's Rebellion. Now, this rebellion happened in Norfolk. It was a massive rebellion, and this was all against privatisation of land. These were the people who were, I suppose, trying to stop this. What they could see was the pernicious progress of this land privatisation, which ended up up here in the clearances and the Battle of the Braes up in Skye. But there were people throughout the hundreds of years that the enclosure was going on who were really making strenuous efforts to stop it. And I speak to a lot of... Well, it's one of those questions I often ask young people. Kett's Rebellion, have you ever heard of it? No. It was about 6 or 8 weeks. The entire north and most of East Anglia was run from underneath an oak tree by Robert Kett. He was a landowner. When he decided to enclose his land, his estate was surrounded by peasants who said to him, "What are you doing, Robert? You said you would never privatise your land, that this was all going to be common land forever for us all to use." And his answer was simply, "Well, look, everybody else, all my surrounding landowners are privatising, and if I don't, I'm going to end up with nothing. But I'm with you," he said. And he led the revolt for 6 weeks. They actually turned back the king's army that came to put down the revolt. They went round identifying all of the big landowners who'd privatised the land, who'd enclosed their land, and they were brought before Robert Kett and asked to give an explanation. And if they didn't give an explanation, which most of them didn't, he locked them up in Norwich prison for stealing the land. Theft. Simple. It's there on the statute book. You've stolen the land, you're in jail. And this was obviously exciting for all the peasants who found that they'd had a champion. So these kinds of little bits of history have often been quite deliberately hidden from us. Then we had the English Civil War in the 1640s, which the Scots had a bit to do with, obviously. But that was the big change, which was from the feudal system over to the merchant classes as the merchants came in. And the feudal classes are still there. We were talking about the Queen earlier on and that whole system. I mean, for example, we've got the Nobel Peace Prize, haven't we, just awarded to the European Union. How strange is that? I mean, who is it at the European Union that is in charge of foreign policy? It's Baroness Ashton. Baroness Ashton's never been elected to anything in her life. She wasn't even elected when she was treasurer of the campaign for nuclear disarmament because no one else wanted to do it. She also answers to who? She answers to the royal family. She's a baroness. This is I don't know what's going on with the Nobel Prizes. I mean, they don't seem to be making much sense anymore. Unless the idea is to pin a Nobel Prize, as they did on Barack Obama, to say, you know, wouldn't it be a bad idea if you started a war now? So there may be that side to it. But the whole thing seems very, very peculiar. So anyway, the Civil War, Cromwell beat the feudal class. And I would suggest that one of the main reasons for the English Civil War, and this is something which very few, I mean, I can't persuade a lot of other people who are Civil War scholars because they're so embedded in the traditional idea that ship money and taxes were what was responsible. But what had happened just in the run-up to the English Civil War was that the ordinary people had been being kicked off the land through enclosure again and again and again. And there were a lot of people starving by the wayside, living in hedges, this kind of thing, because they had nowhere to live. They'd been evicted. And what happened was Charles I, to make a bit of money, decided to tax all of the people who'd been enclosing. So if you've enclosed your estate, you've got to pay this tax. That was in the late 1630s. And this tax obviously annoyed all these landowners who are merchant classes who are making a lot of money out of privatising land and kicking people off, evictions. One mistake Charles I made was that he made some of these taxes retrospective. So people who'd enclosed when it was legal to do it were finding that they had to pay a fine. Anyway, in my own view, that's why the Civil War happened, is that the merchant classes and the rich landowners decided, we're not having this. And they then started organising against the king. But anyway, so the merchant classes, the City of London effectively then took over control of England. One of the first things they did was in 1694, the incorporation of the Private Bank of England. So another important aspect to all of this was that you've got the idea of banking and money and finances for the country is something which is privatised too, run by private individuals. Now, this is the big problem we've got now, of course, isn't it? Because the Treasury and the Bank of England are trying to do their thing, but all of their quantitative easing and all the various other things that they're doing to try and kickstart the economy has got to go through this airlock called the City of London. And what happens is, well, because we've got a criminal gangster class in the City of London now, none of that money is ever going to get through to the general public and into the rest of the economy. It all gets sucked in by the banksters. And that whole situation started back in, as I said, back in 1694 with the incorporation of the Bank of England. If this government wanted to do anything about the financial crisis, they could very easily allow the banks, the free market approach, to collapse because most of them are running on dodgy accounts, Enron accounting, and they could spend money directly into the economy on infrastructure projects, you know, that kind of thing. A very, very simple thing to do, but you will very rarely hear that idea mooted because it's not what the rich and powerful want. Which, what does that say about the health of our democracy? Now, one of the aspects to all this, I mean, we heard a little bit about Freemasonry before. Freemasonry is very big in Scotland. It's very big in Bristol, actually. And one of the most fascinating aspects to all of this is that it took, and this is the guy, Adam Weishaupt, in Germany, who was a professor of canon law in Goldstadt University. And one of the things I found out about this guy, he started this order called the Illuminati. This was like, you know, the biggest scandal of all scandals. Like almost, I mean, I'm trying to think which is there really anything? Maybe the MP's expenses scandal or something, you know, which has gone on and on even though it's been slightly overblown. Back in the late 1700s, everyone was talking about this guy and about his organisation. It was a massive scandal. And it was actually a guy from Edinburgh University, Professor John Robison, that wrote a book called The Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe. That was in 1793. He was a close personal friend of James Watt, who's the inventor of the steam engine, you know, the engine of the Industrial Revolution. Robison, ironically, what he was doing with this book was translating from German and French into English all of the pernicious methods of Adam Weishaupt, one of which was that the organisation would always appear under another name. It would never appear under its own name. The organisation would use women, use the wish for women to be emancipated against humanity and flatter the women. All this stuff is laid out in these German writings, and he was a fluent German and French speaker, Robison. So I'd recommend if you're interested in what went wrong with Freemasonry back in the late 1700s, this is the guy to read. And he's a very readable book. But the irony is, I mean, this is really a message to us down through history about power and about how it can be abused by cults. And that's what we were dealing with the Nazis, wasn't it? I mean, we're still dealing with this kind of thing with Scientology and other cults that are in our society. Freemasonry is a religious cult. But I think in Robison's day, it was largely a benign organisation that was a kind of speakeasy where people didn't have to be quite so formal as they did in ordinary society in that way. So the irony really was that he was the inventor of the siren. In a way, sounding his siren through history to us, saying, listen to this and don't forget about it because this organisation is storing up trouble for the future. Now, I have absolutely no idea whether an organisation calling itself the Illuminati exists today, but certainly those ideas of using cults and secret societies to infiltrate positions of power is absolutely rife, I would suggest. I mean, I've seen it in our own city, you know, with one of our Masonic MPs who's been promoted, even though at the local city council he was known as the invisible man. He never turned up for council meeting. But suddenly he's made an MP. In fact, he's made an MP in one of the most important constituencies in that whole part of the country, because there's a big privatisation of an airport going through, Filton Airfield. And this is the sort of, you know, you could see little glimpses of where these secret societies, where these cults are pernicious. So one of the things that Robison talks about in his Proofs of a Conspiracy is this conference, which took place in 1782 at Wilhelmsbad, which was essentially where the whole of Freemasonry was converted into this kind of illuminated Freemasonry. At least that was the attempt. Then we go on to the French Revolution. And one of the things that the horror writer and Second World War deception planner Denis Wheatley says is that the French Revolution was a long-term retribution for Philip the Fair's attack on the Templars. That what actually happened in the French Revolution was all of these aristocratic bloodlines that were connected with Philip the Fair were put in the guillotine. You know, there's a very direct connection between the two. This was one of those long-term grudges you sometimes hear about. The other thing about Weishaupt is that he was ostracised in Germany. The guy was on the previous slide. He was ostracised in Germany. He was exposed, went underground, but he was given a pension and a room and a library by none other than the Duke of Saxe-Gotha. So many of you will know that this is the same family that have given rise to our present monarchy, the Saxe-Coburg family. And they had to change their name in the First World War because of these Gotha bombers coming over. They thought that was a little bit bad for their PR. Anyway, getting on to some of the nitty-gritty with land. How much do we pay for our rent? This is another question which is very much more up-to-date, and I'll just take a little excerpt for this. A six-bedroom house costs around about £1 a week. That's what it should cost. Now, you're looking at me, what are you talking about? The labour cost is around about 800 man-hours to build a house. That's the labour cost. The material costs about 700. That's 1,500 man-hours to build the house. At £10 an hour, that's £15,000. So why is it? And if you assume that the house lasts for 200 years, that's about £1 a week. So why is it we're paying so much more than that? Isn't that one of those weird things that you think, well, because it's a racket. There is the mortgage companies, and there's also the people who own and buy and sell land that are taking their cut from all this, and, of course, the private landlords. But just bear that in mind. If you're talking about actually just building a house that's going to last for a couple of hundred years, several generations, you should be paying £1 a week rent. One of the things I've been looking into as well to do with the Bilderbergs, and we'll come to them now. The Bilderberg Conference started in 1954, but just in the last year or so, I've been doing some research with various people who've come to me with information about this, and I find it fascinating that the guy that started all this, and this is one of the things that piqued my interest about the Bilderberg conferences, this elite conference that takes place once a year in Europe and the US. It'll be in Europe, so you can have a chance to visit it this year, probably. Next year, sorry. It was the involvement of this guy, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. Now, Prince Bernhard, he was a particularly nasty chap in that he lied and lied about whether he was a Nazi or not, and then eventually it was in his biography that he was actually in the SS. And this is the guy who was the first chairman of these Bilderberg conferences. The other person involved was a Freemason, Joseph Rettinger. But the thing that, as we've dug out over the last year or so, was the involvement of two Bilderberg people in the complete disaster of Operation Market Garden, which was the biggest airborne operation in history in September 1944. We had Bernhard, as many people would say, a Nazi spy, in Whitehall in the planning of Operation Market Garden. So, presumably, feeding information about the exact plan straight to the German High Command from inside Whitehall. And the other person involved is Lord Carrington, because Lord Carrington was sitting in a tank as part of the Grenadier Guards, and he was the chairman that took over from Prince Bernhard when Bernhard was caught taking a bribe of $1 million to buy Lockheed Starfighters. Carrington was the guy who, along with the tanks at Operation Market Garden, failed to go down the road to Arnhem. If you've ever seen the film A Bridge Too Far, there's an incident with, I think it's Ryan O'Neill, Robert Redford, where he has a shouting match with the Brits. He says, go down the road. Well, I actually spoke to the guy that said that, because they're basically sitting around making tea, yeah, while the British are dying in Arnhem, just down the road. And I spoke to the guy in the US, Moffat Burrows, who's still alive. He said, I went up to Carrington and I pointed my Tommy gun at him and I said, get down the road now or I'll blow your bleeping head off. And this is the Americans that had just taken the bridge. Carrington had driven his tank across the bridge and then decided to stop and have a cup of tea. So there are a couple of reasons why that might be significant, in that many people say that the failure of that operation meant an extension of the war. Now, we're back down now to talking about the Nazi continuity networks and the opportunities that the Nazis then had to take the wealth out of Germany, the looted wealth from Europe to South America, and it extended that period of time that they had to do that. So this is the Bilderberg organization going almost rewind. And the weirdest thing about that all was that the Bilderberg conference, the very first conference, took place in a hotel in the exact perimeter where that battle was being fought, in Oosterbeek, which is just a peripheral little town around the outside of Arnhem, which was the main place where Market Garden was fought. And the Germans at the time called it the Hexenkessel, which is the witch's cauldron, because they had these British troops surrounded and they, for days and days, were just pounding them with all sorts of artillery, rockets, and it really was what you might call a slugfest. It was massacre. And that was the place where they chose to hold the first Bilderberg meeting. I think the best way to finish is really by running you through some of these Nazi continuity characters. This is one guy. Does anyone recognise him? Because Prince Charles is one of his biggest fans. He was the Nazi armaments minister and architect, Albert Speer. If anyone has never seen it, there's a brilliant Jonathan Meade's programme about the Nazis called Jerry Building. And it is unbelievable. When the BBC released the Jonathan Meade's collection on DVD, it wasn't in there, because it is way by far the best thing I think Jonathan Meade has ever done. And he makes a reference to a sideswipe at Charles for being such an admirer of this Nazi architect. And he spends the entire programme really taking apart Nazi architecture. So that's Speer for you. The next character is Rudolf Hess. Now, Adolf Hitler, as all nasty characters, always likes to have sort of several deputies who were vying for his attention, and Hess was one. The other one was Martin Bormann. Hess did this kind of mercy mission up here to Scotland, didn't he, that many people know about, where he was actually quite seriously trying to negotiate with the British to have some kind of ceasefire so they could join forces against the Russians, and he got nowhere with that, which was great for Martin Bormann, because Martin Bormann was then the unchallenged favourite of Hitler. So here's Bormann. He was, you know, Hitler's deputy. He was the second in command. And he was charged with taking over from Hitler when Hitler finished. Now, there are all sorts of rumours about what happened to him at the end of the war, as there were with Hitler. Hugh Trevor Roper wrote the story of what happened to Hitler. I've some serious questions about whether there was whether Hitler survived the war. I think he might quite possibly did, because Hugh Trevor Roper was an MI6 guy who really saw history as something you just made up as you went along. He died recently, by the way. And so this continuity network was started by Bormann after the war. He was taken across to South America, and there's very little good information on this, but one book stands out above all others, and that's this. And some of what we do as journalists really is just about reading the right book at the right time. And this, for me, was absolutely the right book. Paul Manning worked for CBS News in the US during the Second World War. And what he did was, after the war, in 1982 or 1981, he sat down and with his own money and 2 years of his life, decided to write this whole story down about the financial network which the Nazis had put together in South America. Bormann set up 750 businesses. He was an administrator, basically, in different countries around the Western world. And in those businesses, he invested the looted money from Europe. On the boards of those companies, he put former SS people. in, you know, without their swastikas on, but in nice suits, and also gave them sort of, you know, a mission to take over one particular part or another. You know, they were all set out on an economic mission. And in my view, this is what we're dealing with today in many ways, is this succession of very, very, almost as powerful, if not more powerful, say, than a tank division, is a business that comes in and takes over your area. I mean, we've had, for example, Kraft come into Bristol recently and take over what was the Cadbury's chocolate factory. They've just completely decimated a large part of our employment in the area. They promised that they were going to keep the factory open. As soon as they took it over, they closed it down. These kind of economic networks, I think, are extremely powerful. And of course, if you've got these people in the banking sector, then you've got some really serious problems. And I would link this in with the Bilderberg, secret kind of Bilderberg networks too. One of the things that is really important to point out about what happened in South America and what happened after World War II was the complete failure of the British and the Americans to pursue war criminals properly. A lot of those war criminals were seen as actually very, very useful in the new fight against the Soviet Union. And the only people in the late 50s and early 60s who were doing anything about Nazi war criminals, and some of the most pernicious people on the planet, were the Israelis, was the Mossad. They were very active in South America. And Issa Harel was the leader of a snatch squad from the Mossad who tracked down Adolf Eichmann. I'd just like to read a little quote from that Paul Manning book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. This book, by the way, just after it was published, the publisher had his kneecaps broken, and the author's son was shot dead in New York. His first son, his second son, is still alive, I believe. So much emphasis is placed on select Jewish participation in Bormann companies that when Adolf Eichmann was seized and taken to Tel Aviv to stand trial, it produced a shockwave in the Jewish and German communities in Buenos Aires. Jewish leaders informed the Israeli authorities in no uncertain terms that this must never happen again, because a repetition would permanently rupture relations with the Germans of Latin America as well as with the Bormann organization and cut off the flow of Jewish money to Israel. It never happened again, and the pursuit of Bormann quieted down at the request of these Jewish leaders. Bormann's residing in an Argentinian safe haven, protected by the most efficient German infrastructure in history, as well as by those whose prosperity depends on his well-being. So, in other words, to paraphrase Paul Manning, money talks. Nazi money talks. And it can even buy the Israeli leadership. And that's what happened, because Issa Harel was then sacked from his job after he'd managed to capture Adolf Eichmann. And there was no more real pursuit of the Nazi war criminals by the Israeli state. So this was a bit of a revelation to me, that there'd been so much actual documentation of what had happened after World War II with that looted Nazi money. Before we finish, I'd just like to sum up with a few sort of stories from more of the present day, I suppose. First of all, the lack of talking about Operation Gladio. Every terrorist attack in Europe should be put in the context of this NATO operation, where NATO operatives, fascists who were recruited by NATO, were blowing up things and blaming it on whoever the enemy was at the time, usually the Russians or the far left, left wing, people like the Red Brigades, even potentially many people will say the IRA. We certainly don't know for sure who planted the bomb in Birmingham that the Birmingham Six went down for, the Guildford Four. These were miscarriages of justice, but who planted those bombs? There was an organisation being run by NATO. I mean, we hear now, don't we, about Colonel Gaddafi killing his own people. What about NATO killing us, ordinary innocent civilians here in Western Europe, in order to blame it on whoever the bad guys are at the time? So that was in the 1980s. Then we saw briefly with P2, the P2 Lodge, when the parliamentary investigations into Gladio took place in Italy, we saw there was a shadow government going on, where the police chiefs and heads of business were meeting up to decide what the government of Italy was going to do behind the scenes, even kidnapping the Prime Minister, Aldo Moro. Shadow government, absolutely exposed. If anyone doesn't know about the P2, have a look at that. We've had the big lie, which I don't really need to go into, the 9/11 with Building 7 collapsing into its own footprint, no plane hit it, rigged with explosives. the rise of the private military companies. People say the government do these things. I don't think they do. I think this is companies like Blackwater and XE carrying out these kinds of operations for profit. They were touting around on their website, I saw a couple of years ago, we are the best nuclear war fighting organisation in the world. We have all the tactics for you if you buy our services. Now, this privatisation of the military is exactly what Orwell warned us about back in the 1940s and 1950s. I suppose the way to finish, maybe, on the Bullingdon Club, because we've got a situation now with a whole bunch of people from an Oxford society, some would say a secret society. You're certainly not allowed to know who the members were. We see some photographs occasionally in the Daily Mail with people airbrushed out of those photographs. Certainly the people involved in this Bullingdon Club who seem to have just decided from the word go that they're going to put their own friends into power and propel their mates into power is Osborne and Cameron. Those are quite key people. Many people don't know that Jonathan Ford at the Financial Times, who's a leader writer for the Financial Times, another Bullingdon Club boy. Nathaniel Rothschild, another one. Very powerful city banker from the banking dynasty. Money coming out of his ears. No problem, of course, with him needing to claim benefits. And another one, we have Boris Johnson, another obvious one. But David Dimbleby. How many people have seen the clip with Boris Johnson actually pointing out David Dimbleby as another Bullingdon Club boy on Question Time? So we're starting to move towards what I think is a really pernicious, what with the royal family making these kinds of putting these kind of pressure on government ministers and the Bullingdon Club of millionaires, led by the son of the pioneer of tax havens. If we were to force those with wealth in this country to declare that wealth and to tax it by whatever means, this financial crisis would be over overnight. No problem at all. In fact, even the banks would probably be able to be paid off. The deficit would be gone. But we're led by a man, David Cameron, whose father, Ian Cameron, is the pioneer of making sure that you're not going to get taxed, however much your wealth is. So that's the situation we're in now. It certainly isn't democracy. And the media, as I think, hopefully, I've illustrated for you, is simply not doing its job in calling these people to account. So I'd just like to thank you very much for listening. And now some questions, if you have some.
Tony, thank you very much for connecting even more of the dots. I'm sure more and more people, anybody that's not aware of it, has now understood how today has moved slowly through a process where you can see the links that extend. You touched on the Templars. How far back this goes, none of us really know. We can only make these links and make these guided assumptions of what is going on. But Tony's work is empirical, it's proven. He does have his own ideas, as he says, but his research work, I would advise you to go and have a look at Tony's site, because his research is empirical. And he does.
Can I just say one thing about the book? Thanks for leaving it on there, by the way. The book is actually available free as a PDF. It's one of those weird things, yeah. You know. If you wanted to buy that, it's about £150, £200 for an actual copy of the book. But, you know, it's one of those things that I just think someone somewhere should reprint it. I just don't know if they're going to get their legs blown off or something.
Yes, but, well, you know, well, what happened?
What Paul Manning did by putting this thing together is an incredibly brave thing to do, really. And a single-minded person. And this is what I was talking about journalists. We sometimes get an insight into some pretty dark stuff. And there's a big decision that we all have to make then, is do we share that with the public or do we just shut up and run away?
One thing,
and Paul definitely didn't do that. You can follow what I'm doing and with my colleagues online. We have a weekly two-hour politics program we do on FM in Bristol, but you can pick it up on online and have a listen to the stream sometimes. Yeah. I mean, it's actually, what we do is the first hour we talk to a local politician, not about the Illuminati, but about the serious issues affecting the city, such as privatisation. The second hour, we float the boat out a little bit. We do a bit more investigative stuff. But that's all at thisweek.org.uk.
Check out Tony's site to
get it. If people want to download some of the old shows, or have a flick through and see if there's anything that interests you, any topic.
Great.
I'd be really interested to hear what journalistic code you'd recommend, and also Are there journalistic resources for people to go out and do citizen journalism, if you like?
Well, great question. Yeah, Journalistic Code is the National Union of Journalists Code of Conduct. And the union has been considering the possibility, although this is a bit of a like turning around an oil tanker, actually, of actually allowing bloggers to become members of the union. Because there are people, for example, if anyone knows Craig Murray's blog, Craig Murray is a former ambassador to Uzbekistan. He's a whistleblower. There's a great deal of pressure from the mainstream media in the NATO countries to make this guy disappear or attempt to humiliate him when he comes on to Newsnight very occasionally. There's a couple of figures to do with Craig. 32 times he was phoned by the BBC to come on national TV or radio. 32 times he was phoned back to cancel. Craig's a very interesting guy. He's a blogger. There are some really, really interesting people out there who are able to do the blogging. The thing is, how do you translate that into a national newspaper? What we're facing is some very litigious people out there. But ultimately, you can get this information out, obviously, through the internet. And by putting stuff onto YouTube, you enable a lot more people to at least potentially be able to see it. I don't think there's any real substitute for having a mainstream press, particularly a BBC, which we're all forced to pay for if we want to have a television, you know, some more integrity there. And all this business with Newsnight stopping the piece about Jimmy Savile, for example, has got to be pressed home. I mean, we also had the Holly Gregg piece, apparently, which was recorded for the BBC up here, I think, which was also cancelled. So when we see important pieces of journalism that have been, that journalists have stuck their neck out to make, then cancelled by editors and lawyers, we really need to be asking some questions about our national broadcasters and are they doing their job anymore? Because it seems they're much more interested in listening to the lawyers and to powerful money speaking than they are actually doing their job. And we need to hold them to account and complain as vehemently as we can when we see this kind of censorship, because it's absolutely pernicious. When journalists work on a story, go and interview individuals, they put their lives on the line for those journalists, and then that stuff never appears. This has an absolutely stultifying effect on freedom of speech, and it means that the next time those journalists will think twice, well, is it really worth it, because we may not actually get it out. Catherine Gunn, you might remember a few years ago, she was a worker at GCHQ and in Cheltenham, and she went to The Guardian with some evidence that the Americans were trying to fix a Security Council vote in the run-up to the Iraq war. So she went to The Guardian with this printout that she'd sneaked into her pocket and taken home. Now, the wait for her between handing it to The Guardian and the thing appearing in The Observer, as it happened, about a month later, she said was one of the most horrific times of her life, because it could have gone either way. You know, if this thing hadn't appeared in the paper, what would have happened to her? I mean, she's taking on some of the most ruthless people on earth. I mentioned the blogger Craig Murray. I'll try not to make this too long an answer. I mentioned the blogger Craig Murray, but when he first reported through the Foreign Office that it was torture was being used in Uzbekistan to extract information from people, which was then being brought back to London and used by MI6 as if it was all factual stuff, to then go into dossiers to possibly arrest people here in Britain and elsewhere. What happened was MI6 turned up at his embassy in Uzbekistan. They sent one of their people and they said, look, Craig, we've got 18 charges here against you, potentially, which we could use in a court of law tomorrow if you don't shut up about the torture business. And incredibly, Craig said, well, I don't want to decide right now. I want to have a week to think about it. The next Sunday, all those allegations appeared in the Mail on Sunday. MI6 had just given all this, basically all this dirt about Craig, all made up, but used through their surveillance of him. And Murdoch was doing the same thing. In fact, he was keeping a whole dossier on loads of political figures and then using it to blackmail them, effectively. So that's what you're up against as a journalist. So sometimes I can see why you might just want to stay as a blogger. You're kind of your own boss. And then every now and again, you might do something which you think maybe how to get into the mainstream press, phone them up, say, I've got a piece for you, and have a go at getting it in.
I think I'm right in saying, Tony, in the the last few years, the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, there's been more independent journalists killed than at any other time throughout history.
Well, quite possibly.
Or in the Vietnam War, etc.
I think the big thing for me I've seen that's changed over the last 30, 40 years is back in the day, when I was a youngster, you would open a Sunday supplement magazine and you'd see photographs from these war zones. Great photographers like Don McCullen, people like that from Northern Ireland, who'd been right in the front line, risking his life to take photographs that we could see in the Sunday Times colour supplement, colour photographs. I mean, nowadays we get none of that whatsoever. And of course, this is one of the first things that Rupert Murdoch and Andrew Neil did when they came and took over the Sunday Times, is they sacked Don McCullen.
I just wondered, I'd never heard of the Bonington Club. Is that the UK's equivalent to the Skull and Bones America?
Well, I mean, we had a bit of history, didn't we? We had something called the Hellfire Club back in the 1700s. Funnily enough, the Hellfire Club was based in High Wycombe, near High Wycombe, at Medmenham Abbey, and it consisted of a Chancellor of the Exchequer. I think his name was Francis Dashwood. And these people used to have orgies and all sorts of ribaldry, and they were some of the senior people in the country. They used to disappear into a hole in the ground and do all this stuff. Funnily enough, Dashwood was only Chancellor of the Exchequer for about a year before people rumbled that this guy couldn't do his job. He was cutting too much and the economy was starting to falter, and so he was kicked out.
Sounds very much like today, doesn't it?
Sounds a little bit, some echoes possibly of George Osborne. Now, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've got absolutely no confidence in Osborne whatsoever. I mean, he was the oik when he was at Oxford. They called him the oik, and they used to get him to do all the little odd jobs for them, like the little fag run around guy. In fact, when the Bullingdon Club in Oxford they'd have these parties and events, and they would actually, the new members of the club would get blooded. So in other words, they'd come and cut them, spill some blood, and you know, this kind of thing, and they would smash places up. When they smashed a place up, I mean, there's actually some quite interesting stuff about Boris Johnson smashing things up, Cameron smashing things up. These are the guys who were criticising the looters, of course, and the vandals year before last in the riots we saw. Of course, they were rioters themselves. And that particular job Osborne had was to go around the day after to the pub or wherever it was that had been smashed up with a checkbook. And say, oh, how much, you know. That's right. So you asked about the Skull and Bones, which is, you know, Anthony Sutton has written some fantastic stuff about it. And if you haven't seen his YouTube, the films of him back in the 1980s from YouTube, they are eerie, you know. Quite, it's almost like a modern horror film. But certainly you could compare the two, because the Bullingdon Club is a very secretive drug-taking, a lot of, you know, coke-snorting, this kind of thing was going on. And these are the people who are now, you know, in the cabinet.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. The other day I discovered somebody posting these MP3s to YouTube to reach another audience, and of course I was encouraged. So keep doing it, whoever you are. I appreciate your vote of support and your get on and do it attitude. If there's somebody you know who you think might fancy a listen to this show, do pass it their way. Spread the news that there are very important things that we are not told by the television, the newspapers, and the other media controlled by big money.